This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
Openings of jobs, chains of supply, and strawberries of Wimbledon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 7 July, today, Wednesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 9.21 million is the marketplace number of the day today. That is denominated in job openings in this economy in the month of May. A record high, another record high, actually. The good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics told us this morning. JOLT is the indicator, if you're curious, Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, and it shows roughly that there was an open job in May, 9.2 million of them, remember, for every person looking for a job that month. But of course, mixing and matching those people with the jobs they want and are qualified for is where art meets the dismal science. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin gets us going.
Those 9.2 million new job openings are actually a little lower than some economists predicted. But Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute says that number, combined with 5.9 million hirings, is still encouraging.
You are seeing both job openings and hiring is eating away at the big hole that was left in the labor market when the pandemic hit.
But there's more in the data. When Cornell economist Erica Groshen gets these reports, she looks at individual industries to see how job postings in each sector compare with unemployment. In construction, for example, there are more people out of work than new jobs, at least over the last 3 months.
This does not suggest that there's a labor shortage for construction at all.
But then she looks at the service industries, which posted some of the most jobs, restaurants, for example. The recent unemployment rate there is pretty close to the number of jobs available. Groshen doesn't call that a labor shortage, more an issue with low pay.
Somebody somewhere is always going to be having trouble finding workers because they're only going to raise their wages after they've had trouble doing it.
Nick Bunker is with the job search platform Indeed, a current marketplace underwriter. He has a different way of describing the number of openings versus applicants.
I think what we're seeing now in the labor market is more of an urgency mismatch.
Based on a survey Indeed released in June, most job seekers are not looking urgently because of the pandemic or other income. But
lots of employers want to hire right now.
And Bunker predicts that as the summer ends and school starts, more people will be ready to start work. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
We've got a story about supply chains coming up from Nancy Marshall-Genzer in just a bit. But think back with me, would you, for a minute now, to the great toilet paper shortage of 2020. We consumers, that is, we are not quite as worried about getting the items we need when we run to the store now as we were then. But retailers sure do seem to be. And with the new strains on the supply chain, grocers are having a hard time keeping certain items stocked. And thus, supply-demand being what it is, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab tells us what that's going to mean for us.
Every day brings a new challenge for Chuck Lawrence. He owns two supermarkets on the coast of Maine. Like last night, he had to drive 40 miles to the nearest Sam's Club to buy stuff to resell at his store.
I'm going 4 or 5 times a week right now.
This time it was a strawberry emergency. He found out there wouldn't be any in his delivery this morning. Oh, and that delivery, it ended up being late. The trucking company doesn't have enough drivers.
We have help scheduled at 5:30 in the morning to start stocking that truck. It shows up 2 hours later. We got 2 hours of lost productivity, and then we've got to pick it up on the other end.
That's wasted labor at a higher cost. Lawrence is paying $2 an hour more to attract workers. Meanwhile, the price of many food items has increased. Red meat costs Lawrence twice as much as it did before the pandemic. He can't really stock up on that and other perishables. So he's stocking up on what he can. Canned foods, charcoal, bottled water.
We're trying to anticipate supply issues before they happen. Unfortunately, you know, you'll get a curveball, like you can't get toilet bowl cleaner right now.
And stocking up comes at a cost. Ken Boyer is a professor of supply chain management at The Ohio State University.
It's the money to rent the space. It's the cost of the extra time moving around.
Retailers are hoping stockpiling will limit passing too much cost onto customers because people are very sensitive to food price increases. Anant Iyer, a professor of operations management at Purdue, isn't too concerned about supply shortages. But he says if the cost of labor at factories and trucking companies doesn't go down,
somebody has to pay it. And guess who? It's going to be the consumer at some point.
As for Chuck Lawrence in Maine, he's trying to hold off on raising prices, at least until he sees the national chains do it first. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Remember we told you yesterday, well, I told you yesterday, OPEC couldn't make up its mind on crude oil production increases, so get ready for higher prices. Well, it is now sadly clear that OPEC is not a listener to this program. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate off 1.5% today, down near $72 a barrel, $72.20 at the close. On Wall Street today, mostly up at the close. Not a whole lot of enthusiasm, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know all those stories back maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago about coal and how it was on the way out, at least as much because of market forces as because of government environmental regulations? Well, spoke too soon, maybe. Believe it or not, coal use is surging in places like Germany and China and here as well as electricity demand rebounds from the pandemic. Turns out it's tough even for developed countries to completely wean themselves off the stuff in times of high demand. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on the energy desk again today.
Coal's days as a key part of the energy production mix in the U.S. are, to say the least, uncertain. Mines are being abandoned, coal-fired electricity plants being shut down because they're too expensive to run, and policies mandating net zero carbon emissions increasingly common. Long-term, coal is just not a good option.
But short-term, what matters most is the competition between coal and natural gas.
Daniel Cohan teaches environmental engineering at Rice University.
We've seen a big surge in natural gas prices, and that really favors coal being used more for electricity.
But that's not because coal as a resource is currently cheaper than natural gas. Instead, Steve Sakala, an associate professor of economics at Tufts University, says the opposite is true.
When demand starts to recover, what that means is that you're already using these other resources. You're going to start to use more of whatever your most expensive resource is. And in many places, that marginal fuel is coal.
He says many coal-fired power plants sit idle these days, but can still be activated. And coal lobbyists like Michelle Bloodworth, CEO of America's Power, says that's exactly why coal still needs to be part of the energy transition strategy.
Coal must be an integral part of that strategy for a foreseeable future if we all want to continue to maintain, keep our lights on, and have affordable electricity.
Clark Williams Derry at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says coal will probably stick around for a while longer for that very reason. But this spike in use, just a blip.
It's very clear. Coal is on the decline, and that long-term trend is not going to change.
He says the focus now should be on how to help folks transition from working in the coal industry to finding new jobs. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you miss us on the air for some reason, or you just want to go back and listen to something again, check out our podcast if you wanted to, available, of course, on the platform of your choice. If you live up in the Pacific Northwest, odds are real, real good that your air conditioner, if you're lucky enough to have one living up there, has gotten a whole lot of use lately. The East Coast, meanwhile, is its usual muggy July self, and don't even start on the desert Southwest. Air conditioning for all my friends. That, in a kind of a roundabout way, is the through line of a new book by Eric Dean Wilson. It's about air conditioning and how through it we can better understand global warming. It's called After Cooling, on Freon Global Warming and the Terrible Cost of Comfort.
So Freon was the first non-toxic refrigerant. It really made air conditioning possible in the industrialized world. But in the 70s, two scientists discovered that Freon was very swiftly destroying the ozone layer. And the good news is that we were able to phase out Freon. By 1997, the production of Freon in the industrialized world was banned. And that came through a global international effort and cooperation.
Right. You know, it's interesting actually hearing you say that global cooperation led to the banning of Freon and the solution of this existential problem, although it's going to take another 40 years for the hole in the ozone to fully close.
That's
of course,
right.
Now the catch is we can't seem to agree on the actual global existential crisis of climate change. The thing that struck me about Freon and the thing you point out in the book was that it let us cool private spaces instead of just public spaces. Talk about that for a little while, would you?
So air conditioning seems like a great tool in a heat wave, for instance, and it is. But the problem is that when everyone is left up to their own devices to cool, only people who can afford air conditioners get to be cool. So the reason why individual air conditioning, is not the best solution, even in the short term, is that it often falls along race and class lines.
Yeah, you say here the comfort line began to reinforce the color line, which was a good turn of phrase. So we have switched chemicals away from Freon, and yet our cooling habits are only growing, in part because we can, but also in part because the planet's just plain getting hotter.
That's right. So Freon was replaced with another chemical that didn't destroy the ozone layer, but was a major global warming gas. The current administration is moving away from these harmful global warming refrigerants. But the next chapter of air cooling is uncertain. When there are extreme events like life-threatening heat waves, yes, we need cooling. But the vast majority of energy for cooling in the United States is not for those events. It's for when it's 80 degrees outside, which granted is hot, but it's not life-threatening. Car air conditioning is a great example. You can roll down the windows and most car trips are under 20 minutes. You don't really need car air conditioning for survival unless you're driving across the Mojave Desert.
Well, so that gets to another point, which is that, and I'm going to paraphrase here, and you are not quite so short-sighted about it, but basically we've gotten soft, right? We're turning on the AC when it's 80 degrees.
That's right. You know, a designer named Cameron Tonkinwise says, our felt nature has changed.
Huh.
But I think that actually the way forward is to really think about what actually makes us comfortable, because our definition of comfort right now has led us into a world of heat waves, stronger hurricanes, major blackouts. That doesn't sound like a very comfortable world for me.
All right. So look, this is a system, much like climate change itself, right? This is a systemic problem, which we have proven ourselves not to be able to solve systemically. So it's left to individuals. But some guy not turning on the AC in his car and rolling the windows down ain't going to solve this problem.
You know, I think part of the difficulty is that we need elected officials, we need our leaders to really work together. But the paradox of that is that the reason that they'll act is because people from below, people like us, are demanding it. You know, if I choose not to have air conditioning, which I don't have in my very hot apartment right now.
Wow. No AC, it doesn't really do anything. Brooklyn in the summertime?
No AC in Brooklyn. I used it. Last time I used it was 2 days in 2019. It was 100 degrees and it was dangerous. So I chose to use it. So, you know, I'm certainly not calling for banning AC, but I'm calling for AC in life-threatening situations and granting access to it for those who really need it. And then for us to really consider better building design, more trees, better access to parks. These are all incredibly green solutions to cooling.
It's a book called After Cooling on Freon Global Warming and the Terrible Cost of Comfort. Eric Dean Wilson wrote it. Eric, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Turns out there is still a secondary market for old Freon, by the way, reclaimed from vintage cars and tractors. You can read an excerpt from Eric's book about that. You can do it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's got fantastic fruit size.
Is fruit size management, like, actually a thing? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lifted 104 points, 0.3%, 34,681. The NASDAQ basically flat, 14,665. S&P 500 added 14 points, about 0.3%, 43.58. Authentic Brands Group is going public. You don't know that company? Well, you kind of do. It has acquired a bunch of down-on-their-luck other companies. Forever 21, Eddie Bauer, Brooks Brothers, also Sports Illustrated. No price for that IPO has been set yet. Shares of the Chinese ride-hailing company Didi continued to reverse today, dropping another 5% after yesterday's nearly 20% plunge. Chinese regulators this week announced a security review of that company less than a week after it debuted on the NYSE. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.31%. You are listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Among the many weak links in this economy that the pandemic has spotlighted, everything from healthcare to equity and racial justice and more. It has also laid bare the frailty of our supply chain. Chains, actually, because there is more than one, right? All those shortages we've been having early on and now are properly blamed in part on the just-in-time inventory system that companies have been using for decades now, ordering just enough parts to come in at just the right time to sell or to use on the production line. But a supply chain change, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, might be in the air.
He feels awful about it, but Thomas Christie is having to say no to his customers these days. He's vice president of sales and marketing at Veland Chase in Montpelier, Ohio, about an hour west of Toledo. Veland Chase processes scrap copper and brass into rods, which are used in plumbing and construction and for auto parts. Orders for the company's rods are skyrocketing because its customers are stockpiling.
They're trying to overorder to fill their inventories to support their customers because they're seeing such strong demand through the cycle.
Christie tells them, no, I can't fill your order. I can only give you around 80% of the rods you want. He'd like to start stockpiling himself, but he can't.
Only because we really just don't have a place to put it.
That's because he'd need more storage space, which is expensive and in short supply. Julianne Dunn is an economic analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. She says the stockpiling is hitting a roadblock.
I do know that it's having some impact on the demand for warehousing space.
Without a warehouse to store their stockpiles, some companies can't kick the just-in-time inventory habit. And it's not just lack of space. It's also expensive to just keep inventory lying around. Materials could go out of date in storage. And Dunn says it takes much longer now to build up a stockpile because you have to wait longer to get your orders for raw materials filled.
Generally speaking, we're hearing at least double, sometimes triple, kind of what would have been normal before the pandemic.
That may be why, in a survey this spring, fewer than half of manufacturers and construction firms told the Cleveland Fed they were changing how they manage their supply chains. And Dunn says many of those who are turning to stockpiling are just making a temporary switch.
I really do feel like the sentiment that we've heard is we really hope this is over soon and we can get back to normal.
Normal being a just-in-time inventory system. Just-in-time does save money. Parts are delivered just as a factory needs them, with minimal, if any, stockpiling. But just-in-time didn't work so well for a lot of industries during the pandemic. Take the pharmaceutical industry. Hospitals ran short of essential drugs and more. Anna Nagurny teaches operations management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She says stockpiling would be expensive for the pharmaceutical industry.
But if you can't deliver, it could be a matter of loss of lives. It could be losing your reputation.
Nagurny says right now, drug manufacturers import their raw materials and some finished drugs from China and India to save money. Nicole DeHoratius teaches operations management at the University of Chicago. She says the Biden administration is stepping in to switch at least part of the drug supply chain to domestic sources and create a government stockpile.
All of us in supply chain were super excited that it got to the attention of the White House.
DeHoratius says the White House is reviewing the supply chains that are most critical to the security of the U.S.
Such as pharmaceuticals and, you know, did we have the PPE? So which ones do we need to be thinking about, having stuff closer to home?
In fact, the Biden administration is already paying a Virginia drug manufacturer around $800 million to start making essential drugs and build a national stockpile of key pharmaceutical ingredients. Anna Nagurny again.
So it's really important to be prepared for all sorts of different disaster scenarios.
But the federal government isn't helping everyone build a stockpile, so manufacturers and construction firms are still on their own. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Don't know if you're a tennis fan, but Wimbledon's on last week and this. The men's quarterfinals were today. The women's semis are tomorrow. Now, the game obviously is the draw, but over the years, Wimbledon's snacks have come into their own kind of fame. Strawberries and cream is a staple over there. About 200,000 portions are served every year during the fortnight, and they all come from the same farm, which cultivates plants that come into fruit every June, just in time. But a newcomer on the British strawberry scene could upset the tournament summer favorite. The BBC's Victoria Craig reports from the county of Kent in southeast England.
Down a quiet country lane in the heart of a region known as the Garden of England, a new variety of strawberry has been created.
We've called it Ace because it really excels in everything that we see in it.
Adam Whitehouse is a senior fruit breeder at NIAB, the UK's largest horticulture research and development center. He describes the Ace, which he helped develop, as a significant change in strawberry production.
It's got really good juicy flavour, it's got fantastic fruit size, and it actually yields really highly as well.
Unlike other strawberry plants, which typically fruit from May to July, Ace produces berries well into the fall.
The Everbearers, which allow us to pick fruit all the way till the end of October in the UK, have come from a more recent breeding effort. That actually came from the US in the 1970s. But they always suffered with poorer quality. And so with Ace, we've really now got the fruit quality of a June bearer in an Everbearer.
The Ace has been bred with British consumers' palates in mind, but growers' needs have also been factored in. As the plant grows, its leaves shoot to the top, while the arms that bear fruit finger down toward the roots. Even more unique, the berries don't grow in a cluster, but rather they naturally space themselves out, making harvesting a much easier process. That offers potential relief for an industry that's been battered by a Brexit-induced labor shortage and new visa requirements for workers from continental Europe.
We are now starting to hear of labor shortages across the country from sort of 5 to 15%, which, you know, is a significant shortfall for most big businesses.
That's Nick Marston, chairman of the British Summer Fruits Organization, which represents the country's soft fruit growers.
Last year, we managed to recruit probably 10% of the total horticultural workforce. This year, it's proved a lot harder. With hospitality and construction all reopened, we're finding that folks who came to work on farms last year, the great majority of them are turning them down because they actually are back working in their old jobs now.
He says the availability of easy-to-harvest plants and new technology could, over time, lessen the pain of what's expected to be a long-term labor drought.
Growers have done a great deal already to reduce the labor content by growing on raised systems, which are off the ground. So, you know, you don't have to kneel down and to pick berries.
The only question left, how quickly could the ace land in a punnet near you? Well, it'll be released to growers this year, which means it should reach UK consumers by 2023 at the latest. American berry lovers, though, hankering for their bowl of British berries and cream, may have to wait just a little bit longer. In East Malling, Kent, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the Federal Open Market Committee, and that is the interest rate setting panel of the Federal Reserve, of whose last meeting the minutes were released today. All kinds of tidbits in there. We will choose just one. Mentions of the I word. 83 mentions this last time, 55 at their meeting in April. Transitory on the word check scale, 8. And that concludes your Federal Reserve Tea Leaf reading for today. Here is your moment of economic context as we depart. Kind of interesting given where we are in this pandemic and the still developing recovery. Some new data from Gallup. They do what they call a life evaluation index, just like it sounds, how people are feeling about their lives. Anyway, in June of this year, 59.2% of us said our lives are going well enough that we can be considered to be thriving. That is the highest percentage on that index since 2008, which somehow seems like a really, really long time ago. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.